This is Tad DeLay. You're listening to War Machine, a podcast for theological nomads.
We are, all of us, in denial about what awaits us in the changes. Not just the conservatives. Liberals and social democrats deny as well. So too does the left. Denial is a contingency of repression, the putting away of an unpleasant idea. When the repressed surfaces, we react with denial. But repression and the return of the repressed are one and the same. What cannot be confronted converts into strange commitments and violence. This is the danger of our moment. We're increasingly aware of an ecological crisis, really a polycrisis with too many threats. We are fantasizing subjects. We are subjects who desire, but we're not necessarily subjects who desire to know. The result is what we would call a purity industrial complex. This complex taps into monetary and libidinal economies of guilt. The purity industrial complex is material, offsets, negative emissions technologies and green products, and ideological or libidinal, the demand to educate yourself on the crisis, sloganeering science is real, enjoyment of gullibility and self-righteous covering guilt, and so on. It's a forgiveness machine dispensing absolution from a priestly capitalist climate governance. Can we alter course in a storm called progress? Let us reckon with our denial. Welcome, everyone. Justin and I recently spoke with Tad DeLay about his brand new book, published today, actually, April 9th, which is when I'm recording this. It's called Future of Denial, The Ideologies of Climate Change. It's from Verso Books, and it's great. Tad's thesis, which you'll hear him talk about, is fantastic. And as you probably already picked up from the intro, there are some theological resonances, undertones, that show up in interesting ways. You should go and get the book. It's an easy read, relatively, and offers a really clear-eyed analysis of the unfolding climate crisis. In the show notes, you'll find a discount link that'll give you 25% off the purchase of the book, or you can use the promo code DENIAL when you check out on Verso. Also, Tad has a podcast series on the book, which you can find pretty much anywhere you go for podcasts. It's called Future of Denial. I haven't listened to it yet, but if it's half as good as the podcast series he did as part of his last book, it's probably worth checking out. You'll find the link to that in the show notes as well. I haven't mentioned this in a while, but we do have a Patreon, so if you want to support the show in that way, you're certainly welcome to do that. In fact, if you act quickly, you could be the first one to do that. Yeah, we don't actually have any patrons at this point, which is fine. Nowhere to go but up. We're at warmachinepodcast.com. Here is Tad DeLay. Peace. There he is.
Hey, there I am. How's
Hello.
It going?
Lex Luthor's little brother.
Mm.
I'm sure you're like, God damn it, I've heard this so many times.
Oh, yeah. I never heard that one. Yeah. Next you'll tell me a Tad DeLay joke or something. About getting in here a minute late or something. So yeah. All right. It's good to see you guys.
You as well. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. Sorry. Have we actually like conversed like on a podcast before, Matt?
You know what?
You do go by Matt, right? Not Matthew.
Either one is fine.
Okay.
Actually, I was going to say no, but I think we did. We had a conversation around the time that there was a lot of distress about things going on at the border during the Trump administration. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. What podcast would that have been on?
Catecholic Machine.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And I know that we've spoken before, Justin. So yeah. So awesome. Good to see you again. But yeah. Very good.
Awesome. So we're all friends here.
Yeah.
And we were just talking, you're in Baltimore now?
I am. Yeah. I've been here for, how long have I been here? Like 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Just past 3 years in my current role. But the first 6 months was distance because I was in Denver and got the job, and it was during COVID. So nobody was on campus. So they let me teach distance for 6 months. And then, so we moved here in the summer of 2021. And been here ever since. So.
Well, welcome to the East Coast. We're glad to have you.
All right.
What is your current position?
Oh, I am a professor of philosophy at Baltimore City Community College.
Nice. Yeah, what do you tend to teach there?
It's a lot of intro philosophy, some logic. Last year I launched an ethics course. So we use like a little bit of this material and some of like Andreas Malm's and some of my classes for like critical thinking or climate ethics and stuff like that. So in theory, I teach religion too. We haven't gotten enough signups to run that yet, which is always kind of wild because it's far and away the most conservative religious culture that I've ever taught in. Yeah. So it's a wild experience, but, it's the type of teaching philosophy that I feel like I can do ethically. Cause I'm not siloing students into, PhD programs for which there are no jobs. So it's fun. So yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
Awesome.
So, I mean, I think at least half of our audience will have a, you know, passing, familiarity with you and your work, but I think there's others out there who would benefit from a little bit of background. So is there anything you want to give us by way of biography or just tell us kind of who you are, the kinds of things you work on and so on?
Yeah, sure. My background is in, I did my undergrad in psychology. I was born and raised in Arkansas. I never really had any aspirations to do any sort of higher education. I'm the first generation student and didn't really even know anybody who ever did grad school. I thought that I was going to go into ministry for a long time, kind of lost my faith and figured out that, you know, through a series of sort of increasingly catastrophic events, kind of figured out that was not for me. Mm. But I got into the academy and started studying theology and philosophy at Fuller and then Claremont. And so I ended up doing a second master's in philosophy and a doctorate in philosophy of religion and continental philosophy within their religious studies program. And thereabouts, I started reading a lot of psychoanalysis. I came into contact with radical theologies, which is, you know, kind of where our worlds intersect a little bit. I think it would be kind of fair to say that one of the things that I really like about teaching philosophy and theology is that these are fields that were really helpful to me and kind of thinking my way out of the received traditions that, you know, and which is rare, right? Yeah. I mean, usually when people kind of leave their world behind or move to a new city or whatever, you reject the ways of their upbringing. It's usually because of, you know, social connections or traumas of various kinds. And there was, you know, definitely a plenty of that, but, really I fell in love with this kind of world of study because it really helped me kind of expand my mind and think in new directions. I became really deep into Jacques Lacan's seminars and ended up writing my first book while I was still in my PhD program on that. Wrote a second book trying to make it more accessible also while I was finishing my dissertation and then wrote my third book on called Against, What Does the White Evangelical Want? On the reactionary white evangelicalism and Trumpism and all of that kind of going on. the first question in against that kind of launched it, because there's always kind of like this nagging, thing left over from a previous project that kind of gets me started, was just that I was kind of doing all of this research during my doctoral studies on how Americans and people worldwide, but especially Americans, kind of think about the future. And I kept coming across survey data that would suggest that a large percentage of the population, kind of depending on how you ask the question and who you're kind of looking at, something like a fifth to a third of Americans don't seem to believe that there will be a 22nd century because God comes back and destroys the world. We've even had a Secretary of the Interior under Reagan said as much, when he was asked, will you protect the lands for future generations? And in his Senate testimony kind of just says, I don't know that we're going to have that many future generations left before God comes back, And so, So it seemed into, cause I think probably anybody listening to this is aware that this belief is everywhere. Right. And at the same time, I was getting more into climate literature, I think kind of going back to my interest in climate change kind of started, I guess, during college, sort of around 2006, around the time of Al Gore's documentary, Inconvenient Truth. And I started kind of keeping an eye on some of the literature that was coming out, but not very in depth. I don't think it was until the IPCC's fifth report in 2014, I believe, where I first actually started reading at least the summaries for policymakers on these documents. I just started reading a whole lot more and kind of thinking about what's the connection between this religious studies and philosophy and psychoanalysis and political philosophies that I'm reading on the one hand, and this climatology world that seems like a complete it's complete STEM world, right? There's no political philosophy whatsoever. And it can feel kind of out of my depth to be talking about climatology and the physics and all of that on the one hand as a humanities scholar. But on the other hand, I'm kind of very keenly aware at this point that the climatology community will very often feel completely qualified to write books on climate change and not just the physics, but also the political solutions and the problems and all of that without ever having to spend even, as far as I can tell, one day sometimes reading anything in political philosophy. Right. So to kind of wrap it up, it's just such an interdisciplinary problem. And I want to see more humanities scholars engaging what is without a doubt the biggest catastrophic thing that human beings have ever faced since we figured out agriculture. This is the most important thing that has ever happened. I would like to see more people coming at this from more angles than is currently the norm.
Yeah. Well, we have no problems transgressing boundaries or disciplines, right? It's a method, actually.
Well, religious studies is kind of like an incredibly interdisciplinary program, right? Like nobody ever seems to just study religion, right? It's always religion and something else, or this tradition and something else, right?
Yeah. So, and if they do, it's kind of a, well, in my humble opinion, kind of a snooze fest, right?
Yeah, can be. Yeah. There's limits to the attention span there.
So this book, it's called Future of Denial. What's the subtitle again?
The Ideologies of Climate Change. It's just out today, actually, as we're recording this on April 9th. So it just released this morning. And my working title, the authors don't choose I'm pretty happy with how it turned out, but authors don't choose the name of the book. The working title was always Denial Futures, as sort of a play on oil futures. And so it's not even a book about ideology per se. It's a book about different types of denial. And so I'm thinking about that as a Freudian, but also as a Marxist. And I would say that my Marxism probably comes out quite a bit more in this book than it has in past books that were more heavily reliant on the Lacanian thought. So Future of Denial, Ideologies of Climate Change, it's divided up into five sections. It's got a theory of denial that's sort of built around, I don't know if you remember back at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a lot of analogies drawn between COVID-19 and either ancient like Black Plague or climate change on the one hand. And so I thought it would be helpful to kind of like think through what those analogies were, because, if you're doing religious studies, you're often studying systems of thought and hierarchies that came into being with plague in the background, right? And so like part of the ascendancy of the popes in the 6th century is actually very, very much related to Pope Gregory just organizing this basically a mass super spreader event where everybody in Rome that was suffering plague basically got together and corralled together and converged and prayed together. The records record scores of people dying in just the hours of this big march that he organized. But since plagues eventually burned themselves out, it was interpreted as God relenting. And so humans hallucinate salvation and nonsense, right? Reality is actually quite marginal here, right? If you say that God's going to stay his hand and then the plague disappears, then God stays his hand, right? And so I have a whole chapter kind of thinking through ancient responses to plague, the ways that people kind of ignore it or play along with it, or sometimes adapt mitigation technologies and techniques and so on. I have a whole discussion of carbon offsets markets and what it actually means when somebody is claiming to be, you know, 100% carbon free, even if actually all of their power is coming from fossil fuels. I have a whole section, three different chapters on the sciences. So like the paleoclimates, the current state of IPCC science, and then one on the whole history of climatology going back to before the American Civil War. The basics of it were already established that long ago, right? It's very common today to kind of say, back in the 70s, Exxon knew, and yes, they did. Right. The physicists actually kind of knew in the late 1950s. It is when we first start seeing, that discussion. And then after that, I have some sections on what does the liberal want? My last book was, you know, what does the white evangelical want? So I thought it was time to take an axe to liberalism, carbon mitigation technologies, carbon capture. And then finally, at the end, it's the discussion of the migrants. And then in the middle of there, we have some discussion of fossil capital and the law of accumulation, according to Marx and all of that. So it's a very expansive book, and I'm hoping that the style that I wrote it in is very readable. It's not heavily theoretical. It's meant to kind of say, here's this book for somebody who is interested in this problem, but really couldn't tell you what radiative forcing is or what exactly earth energy imbalance means, right?
Yeah, that's a good overview of the book. And I think we're going to touch on, you know, several of those things, I hope, as we go along here. And yeah, you're right. It's very readable. In fact, I was thinking as I was reading through this, because I work in a corporate space and I touch on issues of like sustainability, green IT. And like, I'm going to buy this book for some people here. Who need to read this. But just a point, I guess, about the purpose of the book. You said that your Marxism comes through here. And I think this comes through most strongly in this little Marxist inflected passage here early on. You say, the philosophers have interpreted the ecological crisis in various ways. The point is to change it. Mm-hmm. Drawing on climatology, social sciences, and the humanities, this book builds a hybrid theory of denial for the left, with a focus on languages, fantasies, and behaviors of corporations and governments. So I think that's a great summary. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, tag that on to what you were just saying.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So I'm one of those people where there's only so many numbers and gigatons that I can read about before it sort of start to glaze a little bit, as important as I find these ideas. So I wonder if before we dig too much into your theory of denial and ideology and all of these things, if maybe for our audience, you could sort of set the stage as to what are the climate realities that we're currently facing? What are we looking at as far as the numbers, as far as the kind of proposals that have been brought forward? What are we actually facing right now in a sort of scientific level?
Yeah, sure. So at a most basic level, Earth is in a state of energy imbalance. An object that receives energy must radiate out that exact same amount of energy in order to maintain an equilibrium temperature. So Earth receives 174,000 terawatts of energy from the sun. A watt is a unit of energy per second, a joule per second. So 174,000 terawatts, some of that gets bounced off by clouds and glaciers, and we absorb something like 120-something terawatts. That is the number that we need to radiate out exactly in order to maintain temperature. So if an object receives energy but emits more, it gets colder. If it receives energy but it emits less, then it gets warmer, right, in order to maintain an energy equilibrium. So what greenhouse gases do is make the atmosphere slightly more opaque, just barely more opaque at infrared wavelengths. Broad spectrum radiation comes from the sun. We emit out at infrared, but because it's slightly more opaque at infrared, we hold in a little bit of energy. That unit of energy is measured in watts per square meter. Basically, we are out of energy balance by 1.3 watts per square meter right now and rising quickly. That doesn't sound a lot. 1.3 watts is about the same as like three little Christmas tree lights, but hung over every single square meter of the planet. It's very hard to believe this when I'm going to say this, but the common analogy is usually measured in Hiroshima's per day. Basically, if you take those 1.3 watts and multiply them all across 510 million square kilometers of Earth, you come to Earth is now retaining energy equivalent to a little over 900,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs every single day. Most of that energy, more than 90%, goes into the ocean. And even in when we stop warming by ceasing emissions, luckily it looks like emissions ceasing will cause warming to stop. The energy will keep spreading in the oceans and raising the sea level for thousands of years, right? Which is kind of bizarre to kind of just think like, even if we hit these net zero commitments, we are still going to lose the coast bit by bit, year after year. And that's not something that can be stopped, right? Without some sort of technology to suck energy out of the ocean. And that does not seem physically possible, no matter the technological innovation. All right. So that's the basics of it. It is true that Earth has been in all sorts of different climate states. We know those have a lot to do with Earth's tilt. And then there's some just feedback mechanisms, right? The Sahara Desert, for example, used to be very lush and like a Serengeti. And now it's a desert and it will become a Serengeti again, right? Earth goes through all of these cycles, partly because of how the Earth tilts, but also sometimes it's just you get a little bit of tilt, you get more rainfall, something becomes a rainforest or a Serengeti, and then humans trample it and over time, a little bit less grass here means less moisture, you know, evaporating, which means more desertification. And before you know it, humans stomping their herds through the Serengeti turns the Sahara into desert, or at least accentuates that, right? So it's important to kind of say, yes, Earth has been in all kinds of different states in the past. During the Triassic and Jurassic periods, it was much warmer than it is now. Earth began to hit a cooling period in the last 50 million years because India crashed into Asia and pushed up the Himalaya Mountains, which have the effect of drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere a little faster. So Earth has been cooler. And then for the last 2 million years or so, we've been in the quaternary period where we've gone into ice ages about 50 times, come in and out, right? Or glacial periods in and out. So that's kind of the basics. Yes, the Earth has had a lot of variation in the past. There is no historical reason why we should be seeing the temperature rise that we are right now, except for carbon dioxide, right? And again, this has been understood more or less for a century and a half. The carbon dioxide is 41 gigatons per year that we emit as a global population. A gigaton is a billion tons of carbon dioxide, a billion metric tons. And the U.S. is, I believe, doing about a fifth of that right now, something like that. And we're responsible. The U.S. alone is responsible for about a quarter of a degree of increase in warming. So China and India quickly behind it is the biggest emitter today. And the U.S. is right up there with them. But historically, we've done quite a bit more. Right. So I'm happy to go into far more. I do try to limit how many numbers I put on the page. Some places I broke my rules of limiting to two or three numbers per page. But I do try to pack into the footnotes if audiences want to see how to do the math and predict, you know, how these numbers are going to line up in temperature changes. That's all in the footnotes. So I designed the book to be a little bit of a choose your own adventure game, depending on how into it you really want to get. So
yeah. And I really appreciate the way you frame that, particularly that notion of energy equilibrium, I think is a really helpful, a helpful way of accessibly framing what can be quite complicated situations. But I think mm-hmm. what you're revealing is that at the core, it's a pretty simple and intuitive idea that if you put more energy into something and don't take that much energy out, it's just going to get hotter. Like, that's something I think we can all understand.
Right. Yeah. It's a shockingly, it's just a deceptively simple concept. There's some climatologists I follow who like to say there's a few different ways that we kind of know what's about to happen. One is through studying paleoclimates. Other ways are just taking in situ data measurements, right? You can just measure that the Earth is getting hotter. But one way that we kind of know what's going to happen is that the physics are just really, really basic. And so if we can kind of measure how much carbon dioxide clamps down on the spectrum of emissions, right? We can just kind of say, okay, well, if we didn't have historical data to draw on, if carbon dioxide shuts down this emissions of radiating out in an object that's receiving more energy than it emits, you're going to get this much warming, right? It's actually almost tragically simple how some of these physics work, right?
And I think that framing of it of complex as like a complex issue, I think often serves as a mechanism of denial in a certain way.
Yes, I'm
thinking of a helpful analogy here would be the way that people talk about like the Israel-Palestine conflict, right? It's infinitely complex and it's thousands of years and it's all these things. And this idea that if you can make it complex enough, then you are no longer responsible to act. Whereas if you can frame it as a simple issue, then it actually, now you have a moral responsibility to do something about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's and this is still, you know, as conservative think tanks kind of increasingly back away from saying climate change is not happening or it's not human made to kind of saying this is more complex. We need to give more funds to the scientists to study this so we can, you know, learn more. You even hear some of this language sometimes, right? You know, we need to study this more and learn more about it. No, you don't. What you're doing there is, I mean, we do need to study it more. We do need to pour more money into basic research and mitigation technologies and all of that, of course. And the mitigation technology we need to spend trillions and trillions of dollars on. To say that something is complex when actually it is quite simple is kind of wild. And everybody understands how this works, right? If an object is emitting energy and it's a very small object, then it's really hot, right? Like a 100-watt light bulb is really hot to touch, right? If that light bulb was emitting out not just 100 watts, but 174,000 terawatts, it would, vaporize you, right? If the Earth was emitting out 100 watts total over its entire surface, the temperature would be near zero, right? This is really, really simple basic physics when you start to kind of wrap your head around this, right?
Yeah, that's all helpful. I want to pick up on the point that Justin was just making about moral responsibility, right? And then in some of your responses, you're saying, you know, we need to do this, we need to do that. And I don't disagree with any of that, but I just wanted to pick up on one of the points that you make in the book, which I think is really helpful too, is the way that that little word, that pronoun we gets leveraged in these discussions of climate. I mean, on one hand, you can't avoid it, but On the other hand, it's used in this kind of like, I don't know, injunctive sense, right? Like we need to do this, we ought to do that. And then when it's everyone's responsibility, it's kind of someone else's responsibility.
Right. Yeah.
Which can be a form of inoculating yourself against responsibility. And maybe that's a form of denial. I don't know.
Yeah. I point to the research by Gillens and Page from about a decade ago. There was this landmark study that kind of said in U.S. politics, at least, and this also extends to many Western governments, the average citizen's effect on climate policy or any kind of policy, the effect of public opinion on policy is near zero, is statistically insignificant, right? Whereas elite bourgeois interest or even activist and interest groups do have some measurable effect. So you can think of this in like, what is popular, having universal healthcare or not having universal healthcare, right? Even among Republicans, right? Like something like half or slightly more would like to have universal healthcare, right? Stopping the Gaza genocide is overwhelmingly popular among Democrats. Legalizing marijuana, ending capital punishment. You can go down the list of things that are extremely popular in the world today, and they don't seem to have any sort of correlation to the way that we actually govern ourselves, right? Again, that mysterious little pronoun we, right? And so we could talk about like, you know, what we are we talking about? You're talking about the we that needs to like cut down beef consumption because that's like morally either wrong towards animals or it's extremely carbon intensive. Are you talking about the we that is the policymaker that needs to spend trillions of dollars in direct air capture? Who's the we that we're talking about here? Is the we the Bill Gates that's unilaterally testing stratospheric aerosol injections so that we can make a veil and just keep emitting for forever by kind of dimming the sun? Who is that we?
For the point of analysis, I guess it's probably more helpful to kind of like make those kinds of segmentations, right? Like, who are we talking about? What does it mean in this context or that context? Mm-hmm. So I guess we should talk about denial, what it is, what it isn't.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It just occurred to me, I haven't even really kind of said what my thesis is in this, and maybe that would be a good launching point to get into denial, right?
Go for it.
So my thesis here is that like denial needs to be a flexible term designating a broad range of activity. We often talk about climate change in climate denial as Protestants, right? Where, I don't know, somebody who's really still into Protestant theology would hate me phrasing it this way, but more or less in Protestantism, you are saved by having the correct thoughts, right? It's worded more sophisticatedly than that, right? Like, you know, saved by grace through faith and so on. But essentially we're talking about getting your thoughts correct, right? And if you have the correct thoughts and you think about Jesus in the correct way, then that makes you saved, right? And there's this idea that if we just get enough people to get the correct thoughts, then they will vote for the correct Democrats, and the correct Democrats will institute carbon capture and phase out fossil fuels and all of that. And that just doesn't seem to be the way that actually denial works. And I want to say that denial is best theorized as this tendency to negate threats in accord with material relations, generating symptomatic activity in order to justify and curate and maintain regimes of power and material relations, right? What that means—
Say that 10 times fast.
Yeah, right. Yeah. When we talk about denial outside of climate change, we almost always, like, we intuitively understand that denial is embodied. It's acted out, right? So a teenager who's very reckless, we might say, is in denial about their mortality and expressing that through, like, unsafe sex or drinking and driving or smoking or whatever else, right? Later on, we say that somebody is in denial about what a physician might diagnose. So when they have that pain in their stomach, they refuse to go see a doctor to see what it might be. We talk about somebody who's in denial and expresses it through a midlife crisis, in denial about their fading youth, unsatisfied desire. And so you buy the car, you have the affair, you abandon your family and so on, right? So that's like kind of material expressions of denial. We can kind of keep extending that, right? People talk around their racist beliefs. People drink away their troubles at work. Denial is very commonly discussed as like behavioral, but for climate change, we reflexively confine ourselves to just talking about getting the thoughts right, this very Protestant mode, where you can be pure if you have the correct thoughts, and that's what makes you clean, right? And so I use a very simple, a very, very brief little 5 or 6 page essay by Freud on negation, where he talks about how when the repressed surfaces with his analysands, his patients, he would notice that people would kind of negate what came to the surface when it felt like disturbing to them, right? So when a repressed starts to surface and they become kind of pre-conscious or consciously aware of what they have repressed, Freud said it was very interesting how people would go into these articulations, such as like, it occurred to me this might be my mother, but no, that couldn't be the case, or else it would not have occurred to me that it's my mother. And then Freud says, okay, so when they negate something, very often the thing right before they negate it is what the truth is. And then he kind of expands this to kind of say, okay, one of the things that people do when they need to deny the repressed that's coming to the surface is they will negate reality itself, right? They'll say, this is just not happening, right? Another thing that people will do is morally distance themselves from something. Okay, so this repressed idea, I'm becoming aware of something that I really don't like about myself, some impulse that I have, and I'm not going to deny that this, you know, thing is out there, but I'm going to morally distance to myself to kind of show why I'm not actually guilty, right? So I use this very simple schema of like reality denial or guilt denial. And then I like to joke that Americans and many Western governments conveniently have a political party for whichever form of denial you would like. It's very easy to talk about reality denial among Republicans. And that is something that I don't want to back away and kind of say we're talking about like equivalences between liberals and conservatives. My problem is that the liberals look like the Salvation, right? And that's why they get my ire in this book. There is no doubt to me that the Republican Party, for example, is the most dangerous organization in the world, right? I don't even see like how one could really kind of meaningfully argue around that. But if that is true, then it's probably fair to say that the Democratic Party is in the top 10, right? So Republicans deny reality of climate change, right? But Democrats would like to kind of offer you a nice carbon offset as an indulgence for your sins, right? Or they might, the infrastructure investment, the IRA Act that went through in 2022, biggest climate legislation that we've ever done, right? Like, I mean, there's a package of really good stuff in there, right? But even in the way that was reported, right, the modeling said it would reduce emissions by 5 to 10%. And in the media, it's reported as this is going to reduce emissions by 40% over next 8 years. And that's just not real. That's not what the modeling was actually saying in the climate community, right? And so you kind of get these gimmicks that kind of say, all right, you can buy a Tesla and get rid of your guilt, right? Never mind that Tesla's selling carbon offsets to other polluters. So when you buy a Tesla, you're actually, you know, permitting someone else to emit instead of you. You get all these kind of gimmicks, right?
Yeah. Can you talk about that carbon offsetting and that sort of, you describe it as a shell game?
Yeah, it's three card Monty with the biosphere, right? Carbon offsets are one of the regimes by which global climate capitalist governance is managing the transition, right, and monetizing that transition. A carbon offset, in its simplest term, one carbon offset or carbon credit is usually figured as equal to one ton of carbon dioxide. All right, so one credit is one ton of carbon dioxide. They start in 1989, where an American electric company is trying to offset emissions for a coal plant. And what they do is they buy up a lot of land in Guatemala and plant non-native trees. And then they bar the local populations from cutting down trees for firewood. So it's not just purchasing from poor indigenous communities. It's also legally and violently suppressing them often, right? And the American liberal who buys the carbon offset, when you buy a plane ticket and you click yes for, do I want to buy an extra offset to offset my emissions or whatever, you see that as like an offer to do something good. But what it very often means is that you are concretely hurting poor indigenous communities somewhere else in the world. So carbon offsets work. There's a number of accrediting bodies, and there's a lot of different ways that this works. So one that I explore in the book is Delta Airlines claims to be carbon neutral now. They set a goal right before the pandemic. And just to be clear, there is no alternative for jet fuel, right? If we replaced all the space in a 737, if it didn't fall apart in the air, with lithium ion batteries, it could fly for about an hour or two at max. So there is no meaningful way to kind of have like sustainable jet fuel right now. We're looking at like hydrogen fuel cells, and that looks somewhat promising, but right now that's a ways off. Delta claims to be carbon neutral. They set this goal right before the pandemic hit of reducing emissions. Basically everybody would have hit any sort of goal that year because like airline travel tanks. But by the end of the year, they were claiming to be carbon neutral. And if you look up their ESG report, their environmental social governance report, ESG is, by the way, like, this, we can get into that if we want. The right calls it woke capital. The left kind of talks about it as a salvation, responsible market. They're both kind of lying about some stuff. But Delta claims to be carbon neutral. And what they did is they bought up a bunch of forest in Indonesia and Cambodia, forests that already existed, which weren't going to be cut down and didn't plant new trees. They just bought up forests and called it even. And this is increasingly the way that offsets work, right? Is the company buys up a set of trees and just claims neutral. So carbon offsets can look like planting trees, and that might cost a dollar or two per ton, right? At least on the books, not in reality. In reality, it would probably cost more like $60 or $100 a ton. But there's other forms of carbon offsets that would be very real, right? So direct air capture, for example. Direct air capture currently costs $600 a ton. There's hopes that it will come down to $100 or maybe even $50 a ton in the future. But if you purchased an offset that was direct air capture, where you just take carbon dioxide directly out in the atmosphere, that would be real. The problem is that it's just incredibly expensive. If you were going to offset your car with direct air capture credits, you would be paying something like a total, it would be like a $5 surcharge, right? So your gallon of gas would be $8 or $9. Americans aren't going to do that. But if the price comes down to $100 a ton, then the surcharge would be less than a dollar. And I can't imagine Americans continuing to drive fossil fueled cars, gasoline powered cars, if the gas just cost an extra dollar, right? So there's a lot of different schemes. One more example of this, and then maybe we can move on. One way that this increasingly looks for people who are homeowners or paying a utility bill is that your utilities will offer you to offset your emissions or to switch to renewable power, which would kind of like go into the same bucket, right? So I get offered this here in Baltimore. And when I read this fine print, what I'm told is actually that the extra money will go to purchase a renewable energy certificate, which is a way of kind of lining up a unit of clean power with who is responsible for buying that power. All of the power goes into the same grid. You can't actually purchase, like pay more money and get renewable energy only, because it's all going into the same grid. But you can pay more. And what that payment actually goes to is the creation of new renewable energy. So somebody who doesn't know anything about this and is just paying for renewable energy certificates on their utility bill might think that they're getting clean power when actually all of their power is still coming from coal and natural gas, right? And fascinatingly, there's something called an unbundled renewable energy certificate where you take the energy creation and the certificate for it, and you strip them apart and you trade the certificates on the market. And then some firm on Wall Street will buy up a lot of certificates and then retire them. And then they get to claim that they're carbon neutral. So like Apple does a lot of this kind of stuff, claims to be carbon neutral by buying up certificates and then deleting them. Right?
It's all counting tricks.
So this is when I say three card Monty with the biosphere. It's literally because, you know, it's like the little shell game where you're, you know, where's the carbon? I mean, keep your eye on the carbon, right? And then you lose track of it and you pretend like it's fine, right? But the carbon's still there, and the carbon's still going to be in the atmosphere in 500,000 years. Some of it, just by going to get groceries, right? So
right, and the way that it's,
so that's wild,
and the way that it's regulated, as I understand it, is like, right, if I make a conscious decision to purchase an electric vehicle, that's great, I suppose. But in the way that you're describing it, that opens up, there's now a credit surplus, I suppose, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that somebody else can now go and buy their SUV. And this all leads to more and more extraction.
Yeah.
And of course, I think you have the added complication there. Not that I'm trying to say, like, don't buy electric vehicles. I think they're interesting and promising. But you also have the added complication that not only have you created the credit that justifies, you know, your neighbor buying the SUV, but you also have the entire extraction process for lithium ion batteries, which is to violence in places like Honduras and
Bolivia, the worst of all. Yeah,
is probably not unconnected to various coups and things along those lines, and some pretty real violence that is current and ongoing.
Right. Yeah. The biggest lithium mine currently in the world, it's going to be stripped in a decade or two, is in Bolivia. And, you know, when Bolivia had their coup, Elon Musk famously said, you know, we'll coup whoever we want for our lithium. Right. Now he's just like, he's a clown, right? He doesn't actually know or care if that coup had anything to do with lithium deposits. Right. He's just kind of, but that's the vibe, right? Is that we will coup whoever we want. We will get rid of them. We will suppress them. We will strip mine their countries, and we will kill anybody who gets in the way. And then we will tell them that they better be thankful for it, right? And they, and by the way, they got some jobs along the way and so forth, right? And on the EV thing, I do want to say, like, it is important, because sometimes you find on the left people kind of say, like, you know, EVs are just bad because every electric vehicle is an offset for some, you know, Hummer or something like that, right? And I do want to say, our evidence right now is that actually electric vehicles really do, even with all the mineral inputs, they actually are a benefit after something like 2 to 4 years, depending on the brand. They actually are significantly better. What I took issue with in my book is the first year that Tesla was profitable in 2020, the first full year. The way that they became profitable, because they would have posted a loss for the year without this, is they sold a lot of their zero emissions vehicle credits to other polluters, right? And I wasn't able to get data on a granular analysis into all of the carbon markets that they were selling into. But if I took the European trading system, the sort of the benchmark the EU emissions trading system is kind of the benchmark carbon market in the world, which was selling carbon credit for $25 up a ton at the time. If I did the math on that, given what Tesla made from selling their credits that year, what it came to was essentially every Tesla sold permitted the emissions equivalent of 28 vehicle years, right? So that's wild, right? So if you're, and that market is changing quickly as more cars come onto the markets, those emissions credits aren't as in supply, right? So we don't have to worry about that problem as much in 2024 as we did in 2020. But essentially, since a regular vehicle doesn't last 28 years, it was actually worse in Tesla's full year of profitability in 2020. It was actually worse to buy a Tesla than to just drive a diesel, a gasoline powered car, because you were permitting 28 years of vehicle emissions on top of the 2 to 4 years that you would have to drive the Tesla to kind of even it out on the one hand, right? So I hope that's not too technical, but like that's I want to say that, yes, Tesla is bad, a bad actor. Zero emissions vehicles, electric vehicles are on the whole good. Better would be public infrastructure where people didn't need cars in the first place. But aside from that, I just want to offer that, because sometimes on the left, people kind of say, like, you know, zero emissions vehicles are a scam. It's a mixed bag.
Yeah, no doubt. So we've kind of touched on the ecological or geological, I suppose, aspect of this. And there's more, there's much more to be said about that, and much more to be said about the sort of economic aspect of this as well. But I wonder if we can touch on maybe some of the politics around this or the social consequences of this, right? Because, you know, like in political discourse, at least in the state, what passes for political discourse in the States now, it's like there's a lot of concern
and rightly so, about, you know, the growing threat of fascism. And in this context, we're talking more about eco-fascism. You know, I got the sense that in what I was reading that fascism is already here. It's been here for a while. It's this thing called fossil fascism that you write about. But can you talk about what we should expect, look out for in terms of how this is going to impact us, like culturally, politically, that kind of thing?
Yeah, sure. And I'm on the side of being pretty comfortable with talking about a lot of movements on the right today as being fascism. That, you know, there's a big debate on, you know, should you be able to say that F word and what it historically constitutes. But there sure seems to be some family resemblances.
Yeah, that should be
something like me. Yeah, so what I will say is, well, so first off, Andreas Malm and the Zetkin Collective, they wrote a book called White Skin, Black Fuel. And it's a really, really wonderful catalog of the European far-right movements and how they're talking about climate change. And one of the patterns that they notice that I think we are going to see a lot more here in the US is that anytime a far-right government figure in Europe talks about climate change, they immediately also talk about migration. So to acknowledge the science is to do the racism, right? And to drum up the fears, right? And I expect that we'll see more of that, right? So something like half of young Republicans are very concerned about climate change right now. So the belief numbers are going to switch around, but getting more and more belief, you know, again, might actually make things worse in some ways, right? Kind of depending on what the agenda is. One of the ways that I talk about this is, okay, so America is kind of like half and half on the belief question. Is climate change happening? About 70-something percent of people say climate change is happening. Closer to half kind of say it's because of human activity. And it actually just recent evidence within the last few months says that Democrats are actually falling in their belief in anthropogenic climate change now. So the whole arc of history, right, is kind of going backward again on that. But whatever. Okay, even if you get 100% assent within a system that depends on racism for distribution of resources, when you tighten the resources in a system that needs the racism to distribute the resources, what you get is more racism. And that's going to be anti-Black here domestically. It's going to be Black and brown people getting suppressed or squeezed out of certain markets. Blame for their problems, right? Like, you know, like the places in America that are going to suffer the worst in the South or up here in Maryland, these areas of the world that, thanks to the Cretaceous period and what was going on with exoskeletons, ended up having fertile soil and drew slaveholders. And so populations in the South are still much more Black than they are in like the Northeast, for example. So the parts of America that are going to suffer the most are the ones with the red politics, with the higher populations of people of color. And so you can already hear that, like, that liberal Northeastern wise logic, that those pragmatists, those believers in science, those in my house, we believe types that are going to say those dumb red states, they're getting what they deserve. When actually we're talking about like the people of color in the poor communities that are going to be suffering. I also want to say I used to get, I don't know if this is still kind of weird to talk about, but I used to get like smirk whenever I would talk about my concerns of border sentry drones or, you know, various types of AI smart borders or something like that. I don't know that that seems that far off now. The reason I talk about Gaza in my book, which we updated it, like that was the last thing that we updated, was changing to acknowledge the horrific genocide going on now. But the reason I talked about Gaza in a book I turned in 2022 was because for years, Israel has patrolled their border with Gaza with automated sentry drones. They supposedly have a man in a loop, like a little, you know, a 19-year-old gets to play with his iPad and decide, you know, who to select to kill. They had sentry drone, like sentry turrets on the wall with Gaza. And then they would have these little rover drones that can kind of run around. And I think that like with the increasing use of border and military technology integrating with AI, I'm very, very concerned that we're just going to get kill bots. And also, by the way, and so when I say that that's on the horizon, I want to be clear, this is already happening. This technology already exists and it's being tested in the world's favorite killing field, which is Gaza. And also, we should know that, you know, Israel trains a lot of U.S. cops and border patrol, and these sentry drones, they like to say, can be fully automated. And they like to also say they can be loaded with less lethal rounds, like beanbags or gas canisters.
Oh, that's
right?
Nice.
So like, I want you to kind of like, when I talk about like the brutality on the horizon, I do want to talk about the poor. I want to talk about people of color. I want to talk about like indigenous people. I want to talk about migrants. But I also want people to understand, you have no reason now to be surprised if in the next 5 or 10 years you start seeing little Rover Sentry drones that are AI automated showing up to kind of patrol along with cops and, you know, as like they take dogs now at some protest that you go to, be whatever the cause, maybe a climate protest, right? Or a Black Lives Matter protest. Like, you're going to start seeing this kind of technology just running around on the streets with you, right? And it'll look like a little rover or a little robot dog, right, that has a cannon on its back. When I think about the fascism, you know, I pair that with saying, look, our world is some sort of terminal decline, right? GDP growth is stalling out. It's going to hit less than 1%. In any IPCC model you look at, GDP, problematic measurement term, right? Granted, the IPCC expects that basically in any scenario we have, we stall out around 1% growth per year around 2100. It's going to make solving a depression or any sort of quantitative easing increasingly difficult or impossible. And we are going to, I mean, the extractive industries are where you still create value from just the raw materials of the earth. Fossil fuel reserves are worth, by my account, $259 trillion. So they're going to take every bit of that they can, right? Those are all already on the books on some country, right? And even if Exxon and Shell and all the CEOs and the rest decided to keep them in the ground for the sake of humankind, governments would give those same leases to thousands of new startups that, you know, popped up the next day, right? So we are going to burn through our fossil fuels, and those reserves are only a small portion of the total fossil fuel resources that could theoretically be gotten. So, fascism, violence, racism, electrification, economic needs, $259 trillion. You have to think of all these things all together at the same time. It's very difficult to hold even two of them in your head at the same time, much less the whole network.
Because of that, I had this thought while reading the book. I thought there's a sort of, maybe this is too strong of a word, but I thought there's a courage in writing a book like this that's required to, day in, day out, kind of just drill into this data and thinking about these issues. What did you experience like going through the process of writing this book? Emotionally?
Well, thank you. I don't know that courage would be it's certainly not the word that I would have put on it. I did think quite a bit about this comment that one of my editors on my last book on white evangelicals said kind of late in the process. She kind of said, you know, it seems like you probably drank a lot of poison doing this research. And I did feel very much like I was drinking quite a bit of poison, especially when I get to the eco-fascist fantasies and the mass shooters and the way that mass shooters today are increasingly talking about climate change as a reason for why they're doing what they're doing. And so like the El Paso shooter, the Christchurch shooter, it's increasingly the case that climate change and getting rid of migrants is the specific reason that they're naming. I go back and forth on the stress and the anxiety. I think I came into this project feeling a massive amount of anxiety, not least of which was because my first child was born shortly before this project started. She's now 3.5, and then I also have a 1.5-year-old son. So there was quite a bit of anxiety, kind of going back years. I think as I got more into the science and the technologies in the energy transition, I started to feel some types of optimism, because it like the kind of the wonderful thing is that the technologies that we need are basically there. We need some improvements in efficiencies and carbon captures, and we need like a lot more integration, but the technologies are basically there. We could meet all 19 terawatts that our civilization runs on with just covering a half of 1% of Earth's landmass in solar panels. Yeah, I mean, you could just literally just plant them in the desert where nobody is and take care of this. Right? Yeah. I started feeling some optimism that actually the solutions are there. The long-term runaway warming concerns that we used to have maybe a decade or two ago, where we kind of thought, you know, what if you get a certain level of warming and then the tundra melts and then there's all the methane, that doesn't seem to be the case. At least is the most mainstream sciences the scientists that I read don't seem to think that that's very valid. And I've kind of double checked the math as best I can, back of the envelope. And I think they're correct about that. I don't see any reason to kind of doubt the idea. It does look like once we zero out emissions, warming will mostly kind of stop, at least within 50 years or so. But also, so the problems are political. The problem is neoliberalism and capitalism. And that I am more pessimistic about than ever. I don't know what to do with the idea that we were talking about, that we has no power. And there is increasingly this revolutionary awareness and desire, but that revolutionary awareness doesn't have the dialectical conditions for an actual revolution. So it seems to me like what we need is a war economy, right? Like we need a full climate Leninism, right? We need a planned economy, a just transition. But we don't have the dialectical conditions for a 1917 Bolshevik style revolution, it seems, anywhere in the world. The IPCC says that if we want to keep warming below 1.5 degrees and probably 2 degrees, we probably need to have a more or less overnight transition to worldwide social democracy with intense planning. Basically what they're kind of saying is if you want to keep temperatures to 1.5, like the Paris Agreement, basically, everyone's going to need to kind of transition to Scandinavian style social democracies mm-hmm. within the next decade or two. That's not going to happen, right? Yeah. What's going to happen is the governments of the world are going to prop up their legitimacy by extracting as much of that $259 trillion as they can. So I don't know. So I go kind of back and forth on the anxiety. I do, you know, sometimes I feel very optimistic. Not for political reasons, but for technological reasons. And then sometimes I feel quite a bit of guilt about, you know, how do I explain to my kids that I dedicated this book to what I knew was about to happen, you know, right. And it is concerning. And I guess one more thing on that is I'm keenly aware of how safe I will probably be, right? I'm not completely convinced of that. Like I'm not a full doomer, but I'm not a full optimist and utopian on this either. I am aware that there is a possibility I will die by starving or, violence due to some of the collapse pressures, right? I don't think that will happen though. No. I am very, very sure though, that if I have an easy or decent life, it will come on the backs of people who are destroyed by it. And so my incentives, as a Marxist, Marx said, it's not your consciousness that creates your social conditions. It's your social conditions that creates your consciousness and that creates your incentives, right? My incentives mm-hmm. are to be somebody who cares about being a homeowner, right? And who, wants to protect value and wants to have my job shored up. And, you know, my incentives run contrary to a lot of the people who will be hurt, right?
Yeah. So the last book you wrote, I think that had the subtitle, What Does the White Evangelical Want? I want to ask the question, what does the bourgeois, not that you want, yeah. I'm not accusing you. What does the bourgeois liberal want?
Well, so what the liberal wants is to feel happy with themselves, right? To protect their fragile little ego and to be able to think of themselves as a good little player. I always think back to Greta Thunberg that brings, you can never pronounce her name in the correct way. Thunberg is how it's usually mispronounced in the media, right? When she gave her famous speech in 2018 or 19 or whatever it was at the UN and, you know, the we'll be watching you, the how dare you speech, right? I always remember like the audience like starts off when she says like, we'll be watching you, people kind of laughing and clapping. And I compare it to like, it's like they're like reflexively clapping like a pigeons that have just spotted a morsel on the ground, right? And this is the liberal view is that they it's not their fault, right? It might be the person next to them in the next seat over, right? But that message, how dare you, is not for them, you know. And so, I don't know. I talk about the liberal desire for what Hegel calls a beautiful soul, right? Lacan riffs on this as well, right? Somebody who wants to care, wants to feel the angst, wants to be seen as feeling the angst, but doesn't want to pick up a gun and do something about it, or even go to a municipal zoning code meeting to vote down, apply pressure for voting down new gas hookups to new buildings, right? Kind of anything that you could possibly do from the most violent to the most boring, the liberal doesn't actually want to engage in that, right? Because that begins to implicate them, you know? So me as well, right? Like, I think it would be fair to say to write a book on denial as I have is in a way, I think the most correct Freudian reading of this would be that I have more or less sublimated my repressed guilt, into writing a book. Right. And hopefully something good comes out of that, out of raising some awareness and thinking about it. But it's certainly the case that my lifestyle is more or less the same. And all I have done is produce some information about it for people to think about. Right. So what is the value there?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's quite a bit. But go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I feel like it's complicated, though, because on the one hand, you said my lifestyle has stayed basically the same. But I think going back to the complicated we, I think there's sort of a difficult ideology or logic there that says, you know, we could solve climate change if only, you know, we all became vegans or whatever, which is like, is not true, right? This is not
right, yeah.
how this actually functions. So I think that this question of what does an appropriate response or a proper response or what kinds of actions are actually meaningful actions, I think if you don't hold the reins of power, it's really hard to see, you know, what is a possible reign of power that I could have, and in what sense can any of my actions be meaningfully distinguished from something like virtue signaling or whatever. You know, before you hopped on the call, me and Matt were talking, and I somewhat jokingly said, like, is there like a non-terrorism based response to what's being described here? And on the one hand, that's a joke, but on the other hand, it's kind of like, I don't know what effective action that isn't just virtue signaling even looks like in the space as an individual.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me pick up on something I said a moment ago, and then I want to talk about the difference between mitigation and adaptation. Buildings are responsible for about a third of our emissions. Buildings emit both by consuming energy. In the American grid, 60% of our energy is fossil fuels, right? About 40% is natural gas, 20% is coal. The rest is split up between nuclear and renewables. So buildings emit that way, and then buildings also directly emit through like gas hookups for boiling water or like air temperature, right, for heating. And so I do want to actually say, you know, some cities are increasingly trying to ban new buildings from having gas hookups. And sometimes city regulators will say that it's helpful to have the public show up at these meetings and apply pressure because it is going to make things cost more, at least in the short term. And so to get like kind of cowardly, overworked city like regulators, get to give them some support and show up at these meetings, that actually is the type of thing that you can do. It's only going to make a difference of a tiny, tiny, infinitesimally small fraction of a degree in Earth's, you know, future. But that is something you can do, right? Or I'm connected with an eco-socialist group here in Baltimore that's trying to get Baltimore to stop burning trash, right? You know, so like a lot of emissions come from landfill, not like a lot, but a significant measurable amount. And then if you burn them, you know, it becomes carbon dioxide. So there are things that you can do that are not terrorism. They look boring, though. So you have to kind of say, okay, well, if I'm going to get involved in the mitigation, it's probably going to look boring. I mean, I would say that like if someone is considering like a career change, or if you're a student who like doesn't know what you want to do yet, you might seriously consider devoting your life to this issue. Like going into city government as a engineer of some kind, like working on adaptation and mitigation is actually something that you can do, right? You are not going to stop the progress of the storm. You are not going to ban fossil fuels. We know the things that we need to do. We don't have the conditions to do them. But there are things that small spaces for mitigation, right? Okay, so mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation is the side of limiting fossil fuels. There's a small bucket of ways that we can do this, namely three. One is electrification so that we don't need fossil fuels. Two is improving efficiency so that we don't have to use as much energy or fossil fuels that we do. And then there's carbon capture for the rest. Certain things like cement will always emit carbon dioxide, right? And we use a lot of cement to build things. So we're going to have to make cement cost more by putting, capturing the gases at the top of the stack. Okay, so that's mitigation, right? How do we stop climate change? Keeping the fossil fuels on the ground by improving efficiency, electrifying everything, and carbon capture for the rest. That's usually what people are talking about, the average citizen, when they say, what can I do? But there's this whole other discourse, and this is really covered in IPCC's Working Group 2 on vulnerabilities, where you talk about adaptation and maladaptation, that is a whole other bag of things. So adaptation is everything from like more firefighters, building seawalls. The IPCC even, I kid you not, talks about the need to move ski resorts to higher latitudes. Increased flood management and funds for reinsurance programs and all of that. There's a ton of stuff that happens at the policy level, but also as far as adaptation, you can be thinking about the things that the left has always needed to do. Caring for migrants, unionizing your workplace so that people feel like they have some sort of buy-in. In America, we need to agitate way more for single-payer healthcare, right? So that people's health insurance is not tied to a job, such that when the fires encroach or the seas rise, people are able to move. We need to do the things, I even said this in my last book, like we need to do every little thing that we can to disable the scarcity thinking that fascism appeals to. Right? Those are all adaptations. And along the way, if you want to talk about illegal things that you might be able to be like very proud of and actually engage in, if you have like a church community or some kind of community group in your world, you should be thinking about how to give people housing and shelter people, especially as the migrations pick up. Or the people who, for example, lose the value on their home and they're in like debt because their basement floods and they lose value on their house because there's more rainfall. How are you going to take care of people who are increasingly kicked to the curb, made homeless? How are you going to think about addiction as the changes ramp up and the economic possibilities start to tighten more? We need to be thinking about things like hunger and housing and addiction as connected to the various apparatuses of climate adaptation, right? And you don't find that in the IPCC, right? They're not talking about addiction and some hunger, yes, of course, but we need to think about what it means in a world where increasingly you have to choose between doing good, meaningful work and making a buck, right? Where increasingly those are your two options and you could do neither, but you can't usually do both unless you're like a physician, right? We need to kind of think like as the resources tighten, as the fascism ramps up in response to that, as the roars for blood come into fore, how are you able to take care of people around you? That's adaptation. That is the type of thing that you can actually meaningfully do on a local level and it will never show up in the carbon records. And you will have accepted that you cannot stop the progress of the storm, but you can preserve life where you find it, 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 where you find it.
There's an optimism to the way that you're framing this that I think is actually really helpful, because within leftist discourse around climate change, it can get sort of, you know, blackpilling, to use the internet terminology, this mm-hmm. idea mm-hmm. of this kind of radical pessimism, this radical hopelessness that yeah. I think ultimately disempowers people and leads to inaction. And I think mm-hmm. that the framing you're giving, this more not optimistic in the sort of vicious sense, but in the sense of opening up real potential for empowerment, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, and if I can yeah. add to that, it made me think of there's a few years ago, there's a book, I forget who wrote it, but it's called Joyful Militancy. But I think positive affectivity can be as productive as negative affectivity. But to that point, I was wondering, why don't we see more sabotage efforts? Right. If the political option isn't really, you know, if we're not going to vote our way out of this and it's questionable whether there's a technological fix for it, it seems that really the only thing left is to just kind of, you know, seize the means of extraction or at least blow it up.
Mm-hmm. Thinking of here of like the how to blow up a pipeline, which, you know,
phenomenon. I've been in a little bit of correspondence behind the scene with Andreas about some of the schemas that he kind of develops, and he was really wonderful enough to provide an endorsement for my book. But yeah, so and Andreas' mom, you know, writes this book, how to blow up a pipeline, which is not actually a how-to manual, but is an argument that actually the great so-called nonviolent movements in the past have usually included a massive dose of violence, or at least the threat of violence. He cites like the women's rights, right to vote movement in the UK, which included quite a bit of firebombing and threats to kill police officers and so forth. Right, it was a very different kind of world than the way that it's kind of usually presented. Yeah. So, you know, his question is, at what point do we escalate, right? We're being killed. And do you have a right to defend yourself, right? You know, more or less. And so I think you asked, like, why don't we see more militancy or something to that effect? And I don't know. I mean, we have to be real about the fact that the regimes of power in the world are highly invested in fossil fuels and continuing to use them, right? And if there starts to be a movement to keep those fossil fuels in the ground by threatening people, then we're going to see massive amounts of repression, right? We're seeing states across the U.S. put laws in the book that criminalize with hundreds, some tens or sometimes even hundreds of thousands of dollars in fine or jail time for even blocking a road, much less even going in the fence of a fossil fuel infrastructure, right? Of just blocking the road on the way, right? They can put you in prison forever. I even cite, you know, Obama in the book, you know, going to the Coast Guard and talking about how their job is to defend the ports anywhere in the world or something, you know, it's like, well, anywhere, right? Like, if fossil fuel infrastructure is something that the Coast Guard's supposed to be taking, like everybody in the government apparatus is going to be invested in keeping fossil fuel flowing. With good reason. Fossil fuels provide 80% of our power. Fossil fuels are almost 100% correlated with GDP, right? If we stopped fossil fuels today, 3 billion people would starve in the first year, and whoever survives would suffer depression 2 to 3 times worse than the Great Depression. There are all kinds of incentives for keeping the fossil fuels flowing that are not just the people at the very top want to make more money. So why don't we see this, you know, in Andreas Malm's book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, he uses this example that was, you know, published some years ago about, why don't we just see people keying SUVs, disincentivizing people from buying them and switching to lower emissions vehicles. His point is not that you can shut down the infrastructure by everybody kind of going to every power plant and hitting it with hammers until it breaks or something like that. You know, he has a much more realistic view that kind of says, if you can make it slightly more costly to run fossil fuels, then you will incentivize capital to switch over to renewables, right? So right now, sometimes you'll hear that renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels. I kind of dispute that in the book, that it depends on a very kind of tortured reading of what costs are that don't include grid integration even. But right now, fossil fuels and renewables are right in the same vicinity. Sometimes fossil fuels are slightly more expensive. Sometimes renewables are slightly more expensive, right? But if you can use sabotage to make the money, the investments, the insurance, the stocks, if you can change the formula just a little bit, then you can switch the incentive structure to renewables, right? That's his argument. I'm a little skeptical of that. I mean, not least of which is because I know that I'm too much of a coward to do something like that. Or if I was, I wouldn't tell you. But like the truth is I'm too much of a coward to do something like that. Again, my material interests, taking care of kids, holding down a job and all of that, like militate against it, right? But I will say that I would not be surprised if we see more of this. You see like a vision of this in Kim Stanley Robinson's Ministry for the Future, where you have this group called the Children of Kali, who more or less through the use of drone technology make it impossible to keep burning fossil fuels, right? So they start taking out airlines out of the sky. They, you know, use drones to kind of surround certain types of infrastructure and threaten people. And this is all something that could theoretically be done, but I think the forces of repression would figure out a way, you know, if many drones that I can purchase at Walmart started becoming something that could take down airliners, I think the powers that be would figure out ways to prevent that and come down ever harsher. So I don't know. It seems to me that people have a moral right to self-defense, but is it pragmatic? Can you ever expect a mass movement that would be so brutally suppressed on every level by all the powers in the world? You know, I'm a little more skeptical of that.
We live in interesting times, you know.
We do.
I have found this whole conversation and your book to just be profoundly useful for really reframing the way that this debate happens. You know, on the one hand, it's as a leftist, it's sort of always fun to submit liberals to the critiques that they are happy to throw at conservatives. But I think there's something really, not just sort of fun about the way that you do this, but I think really productive about it, that you have, I think, has shifted from a notion of denial as this sort of subjective thing to this notion of an objective denial in many ways. That in many ways, I see your text as an attack on the implicit idealism of liberalism, and it's very much a kind of materialist critique. And I just find that profoundly helpful. So there isn't a question here. I just I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I found it really useful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
Same.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's really good to talk about this, and I'm so excited, and I hope that it is kind of an argument for the left. I hope I'm showing people how to kind of include or kind of connect some of the interdisciplinary work that you're doing with this broader crisis. And I'm also just hoping it's an accessible introduction to it for, I mean, I wanted to kind of say, I think this book is for somebody who's interested in the climate, interesting climate change, but hasn't read a lot of books on it, right? And so I hope it's kind of like an all-in-one kind of, here's what the sciences are, here's what a carbon market is, Here's the history of it, but also here's the psychoanalysis, the Marxism, the migration studies, all of that, you know, all integrated. So so I hope it's a helpful kind of all-in-one tool for people to kind of think through the years ahead.
Yeah, it's a great contribution to this ongoing discourse, I suppose. So, yeah, appreciate it. Appreciate you.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much. It's good talking to you guys. We'll do it again sometime. All right.
Yeah, man. Thanks. Bye.
All right, bye.